Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us. This is a personal finance show on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein. Today is episode 475. It's titled, Inflation's Illusion, Debunking the Normalcy of Currency Debasement. Last week, the Financial Times published in their Big Read section a lengthy article by Kana Inagaki and Leo Lewis titled, Is Japan Finally Becoming a, quote, normal economy? They wrote, Now, Japan's central bankers and government officials say the country is at a historic inflection point and may finally become a normal economy. Companies will be able to pass on increased costs to consumers in the form of higher prices, and workers will respond by demanding better pay. They're suggesting, and have some other quotes from the article, from government and central bank officials, that normal is having inflation, rising prices, which means the value of the currency isn't going as far. It's being debased. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said, We have obtained a once-in-a-lifetime historic opportunity to exit from deflation, deflation being falling prices. We are going to make sure that a positive mindset that will see rising wages as the norm will be firmly established across the entire society. That suggests deflation is bad. An inflationary mindset, expecting inflation, wanting prices to go up so that we can demand higher wages, that's a good thing. Let's see if that's the case in this episode. Prices in Japan started rising in the spring of 2022 after the COVID pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Core inflation, excluding food, rose 2.8% for the year ending February 2024. Wages have also been going up. The country's largest employers agreed to a 5.3% wage increase during the spring negotiations. The increase in inflation has helped the Japanese stock market. The Nikkei 225 stock index surpassed its previous peak from 34 years prior in February 2024. We discussed that in episode 468 of the podcast. In March 2024, the Bank of Japan ended negative interest rates, a negative policy rate. It began that experiment back in 2007. We discussed that in our Insider's Guide newsletter last month. And even I fell into that language trap. In the newsletter, I wrote, the Bank of Japan is normalizing its monetary policy because the Japanese economy is experiencing some modest inflation. I pointed out how central bank asset purchases can boost the money supply if the federal government's running a deficit. That can be inflationary. In the newsletter, I wrote, Yet it's taken 8 years of negative interest rates and other unconventional monetary policies to overcome Japanese households and businesses' deflationary mindsets. Is a deflationary mindset a bad thing? It clearly, we're trying to overcome that, is what I wrote and the officials wrote. Tsutomu Watanabe, professor of economics at the University of Tokyo, said, The virtuous cycle between rising wages and prices began to emerge, and the Bank of Japan started to raise interest rates. It's not complete yet, but Japan is gradually heading towards a normal direction. Now, there are some impediments, as the Financial Times pointed out. They wrote, one major concern is the deflationary mindset that has become entrenched in societies. Watanabe said, among senior people receiving pensions, they may wish for inflation to go away because they feel that life was easier when prices did not go up. We'll see that life is actually a little easier when we don't have to worry about inflation. Watanabe continued, there is going to be a force of resistance, people fighting against inflation, not wanting an inflationary mindset. As the broader mindset is starting to change, the number of people who don't want things to change will be relatively large. Bank of Japan Governor Kazuo Ueda said in March, people should be living without being conscious of the Bank of Japan's existence. We are now at a transition period where we might be able to shift to that kind of situation if things go well. Do you find yourself making investment decisions based on what the central bank is saying and doing? I don't know to the extent that Japanese households did or not. They clearly have been comfortable with stable prices. Japan has not experienced outright deflation, falling prices. They've had very, very low inflation, about 0.8% per year over the past decade. One more quote. Katahiro Yasukochi, who's the chair of the Japanese Association of Metal, Machinery, and Manufacturing Workers, about 390,000 workers that are employed by small and medium-sized businesses, says, "We feel that we need to achieve a society where 2% inflation and 3% wage increases will always be achieved. This isn't just about next year, but over a long span of time, such as 5 or 10 years. A 2% annual price inflation will double prices every 35 years. That's considered normal. Many central banks around the world, that 2% inflation is their target." Before we continue, let me pause and share some words from one of this week's sponsors, LinkedIn. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. In my professional life, I've seen how important it is to have quality candidates to interview so we could find the right hire. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/David. That's linkedin.com/David to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. I've been reading Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money. She raised some legitimate questions when it comes to this acceptance of normal of inflation. She wrote, "If we replace the description of an inflation target with debasement target, which is ultimately what it is, it shows how silly some of these comments are. Debasement, the word means losing value. In the case of currency, purchasing power, we're losing it. As there is more money in circulation, each unit of currency, each dollar, is worth less. We can't buy as much. That's what inflation does. We need more and more dollars or other currency to buy the same amount of goods than we did 5 years ago. That's considered normal." Alden continues, using that terminology, rather than heads of central banks lamenting that inflation is below their target, they would be lamenting that the currency that people earn their wages in and keep their savings in is not being debased as quickly as their target debasement rate says they should. Here's the thing, though. What should be normal is as companies become more productive in building things, making things, providing services, the price should drop because it takes fewer resources, including time, to make that thing or to do that thing. That's normal. But it's not considered normal because the money supply, the amount of cash in the system, it keeps increasing. Alden writes, "To put this another way, central bankers do everything in their power to ensure that deflationary productivity gains are continually offset by a greater amount of currency debasement, so that nominal prices of goods and services, it'd be prices including the impact of inflation, keep marching higher at a slow and steady pace despite becoming more efficient to produce." If we look at the U.S., over the past decade, the consumer price index has risen on average 2.8% per year. But not everything has gone up. Energy commodities are about the same price as they were a decade ago. Gasoline, about the same price as it was a decade ago. Do you have a deflationary mindset when it comes to gasoline? Are you upset when the price goes up? We sort of hope the price of gas stays the same. We're very sensitive to the price of gasoline. What about airfares? Airline fares have fallen 12% in the past decade, about 1.3% per year. Have you stopped flying because you're waiting for airfares to fall more? No, we buy airfares when we want to take a trip. One reason central bankers worry about deflation is that, well, people stop buying, waiting for prices to fall. And as people stop buying, then companies will produce less, we'll get into a downward deflationary spiral. Yet we purchase things all the time that are falling in price. Airfares, gasoline. Apparel has only increased 0.4% per year. They're pretty stable prices for clothing. Information technology, hardware and services has fallen 16% in the past decade. That's about 1.7% decline per year. Now, the inflation statistics are adjusted to take into account quality improvements. And so it might look, for example, a cell phone. iPhone is more expensive today than it was 10 years ago, but it's also much more capable. That same phone from a decade ago, it was operating brand new, would cost less today than it did a decade ago. It's just that because the phones today have more memory, they're faster, brighter screens, they cost more. But the norm is for computers and other electronics to fall in price because productivity is increasing, getting better at producing chips, producing memory, producing screens. Fruits and vegetables, they've only increased about 2% per year. So do we have a deflationary mindset when it comes to airline tickets and gasoline? If we look at the money supply, and the money supply consists of the currency outstanding, so dollar bills, coins, it includes checking and savings accounts, and money market mutual funds, another type of very liquid savings vehicle. Since January 1959, the money supply in the U.S. has increased 6.9% per year. It's just the amount of cash in the system, the savings and checking accounts. In the past decade, it's increased 6.4% per year, even though this money supply has fallen just over 4% since March 2022. But about a 6% increase every year on average in the amount of money happening. Yet inflation was half that, 2.8%. Why hasn't inflation kept up with the increase in the money supply? Because companies are getting more productive. They're getting better at producing things more efficiently, and that keeps the inflation rate down. So that, as Alden pointed out, the central banks are doing everything to try to get greater increase in money supply so that inflation isn't zero, so we don't have stable prices. All because they're afraid households and businesses will stop buying and stop producing because prices are falling. Now, we use fiat currency. The currency is not backed by anything. We've discussed in a number of episodes how the money supply increases when banks make loans. Those loans create new deposits because if I take out a loan, I sign loan documents, and the bank now has an asset, a loan receivable on their balance sheet, and they offset that with a credit reflecting the deposit that I get for the loan. So that newly created deposit, that digital deposit, brand new money, and that increase in debt leads to an increase in the money supply. And central banks try to adjust their policy rates to encourage more lending. That's why Bank of Japan's policy rate was zero or less to encourage households and businesses to borrow money, leading to an increase in the money supply. But central banks don't just leave it at that anymore. Now they want to print money through quantitative easing by effectively purchasing the bonds that are issued by governments to fund their deficit spending. Government spending more than it received in tax revenue. It issues a bond that either directly to the central bank or the central bank buys it in the marketplace. That effectively sends money into the economy. It increases the net worth of households and businesses. New money leads to an increase in the money supply. And as that money supply expands, because households and businesses now have new money, higher net worth, there's greater demand for goods and services. They want to buy it. They want to spend it. And if the supply of goods and services doesn't keep up to meet that demand, that can put some upward price pressure, leading to inflation. Our businesses realize, well, our costs are going up, our input costs, so they're raising prices. And you do get what they call, and I don't think this is a good term, this virtuous cycle of inflation, of higher wages, higher prices. That's not virtuous. That's a royal pain, as we'll see. Look at the Bank of Japan. For the past decade, their money supply increased 3.6% per year, and inflation came in at 0.8% per year over the last decade. So it's not like they didn't have inflation. It was just very, very low. Throughout the time, the Bank of Japan is trying to increase the money supply. They began doing quantitative easing, this purchasing of government bonds to boost the money supply back in 2001. Back then, the Bank of Japan's assets were less than 20% of economic output or GDP. Now, the Bank of Japan owns 130% worth of assets as a percent of GDP. And the amount of government debt because of the government deficit went from 136% of GDP. This is gross debt, including the bonds owned by the Bank of Japan. That's now up to 245%. Japan is, I believe, the most indebted country in the world when it comes to the national debt. Before we continue, let me pause and share some words from this week's sponsors. Quick math, the less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform. And one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. With everything seeming to get more expensive these days, you need to find proven ways to cut cost and boost performance at the same time. And NetSuite can help with that. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/David. That's netsuite.com/David. netsuite.com/David. Now, what are some of the distortions from this inflationary mindset? As consumers, savers, we have to take action because our purchasing power, the currency, is being debased. In that Financial Times article, it talks about how Japanese investors dumped around $70 trillion of domestic stock shares in the past 34 years, and that they, as of recently, kept half of their total financial assets in cash and deposits. Financial Times writes, for many years when consumer prices were stagnant or falling, that was perfectly rational. Why bother taking equity risk if your cash was not losing any real value? If your currency is stable and you can buy the same amount of goods 20 years from now with $100 or 100 yen, you don't have to invest the money because the purchasing power will be there. We have to invest so that we can earn a rate of return greater than inflation because of currency debasement. Financial Times continued, but as inflation has picked up, that logic no longer holds. Savers can see prices rising and the purchasing power of their cash falling. For the first time that many can remember, they need to think about yield and returns. Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to worry about investing at all because our currency was stable? It held its value? Instead, we have to take action. We have to own scarce things, things where the supply isn't growing as fast as the supply of money so that it keeps pace with inflation. Gold is a great example of that. For the 10 years ending March 2024, when inflation increased to 2.8%, gold has appreciated 4.7% per year. It's held its value. If we take it through April 15th, 2024, where gold recently spiked, gold has increased 7.1% per year. The reason being the gold supply, which is about 212,000 tons, that's the total amount of gold that exists in the world. The supply only grows at 2% per year, whereas the money supply is increasing at 6% per year. That's why gold holds its value. Apart from gold, in order to outpace inflation, we can own businesses that can generate cash flow that outpaces inflation. And we typically do that by investing in publicly traded stocks. Owning gold or stocks when we sell them, if we want to sell them in order to spend the money, we have to pay capital gains tax. If you have money and it held its value, you wouldn't have to pay capital gains tax when you spend your money, but we do with investments such as gold or stocks. Some other market distortions that we've discussed in the past, and Lynn Alden points out in her book, she writes, people generally build their retirement savings account out of equities rather than money. Therefore, equities of large publicly traded companies acquire a monetary premium compared to most private businesses. This gives large corporations a lower cost of equity capital and thus gives them a structural advantage over smaller private businesses. Their cost of capital goes down. What that means is the cost of capital equals the expected return for investors. As more households invest in stocks in order to maintain their purchasing power, it pushes up the price of stocks. And as the price goes up, the expected return falls. Lower expected return equals a lower cost of capital, which means as businesses are figuring out what projects to invest in, their hurdle rate is lower. Less attractive projects get funded. In addition, this incessant demand for stocks allows unprofitable businesses that are unprofitable because they don't charge enough, but they can keep issuing stocks to stay in business. We have private companies and even publicly traded companies that still haven't figured out a profitable business model, but they stay in business because of this monetary premium for stocks, because investors have to purchase stocks and other assets because just holding their money loses its value over the long term. And that's considered normal. Currency debasement. Inflation encourages taking on more debt rather than savings. That debased currency benefits borrowers because if you have a mortgage or some other debt, you're paying back that debt with a debased currency. The amount of money in the system, the greater money supply, you're earning more just because of inflation. And so as you take those future dollars to pay down the debt that you took back in the past, there's a benefit to that because you have more dollars simply because of inflation. But because of inflation, borrowers don't have to be as disciplined in terms of their borrowing because inflation, the rise in prices, means their whatever project they're invested in, let's say it's a house or a building, it's going up in price. And so it's generating cash flows to pay off that debt. But if the currency isn't weakening, if inflation isn't there, it means borrowers have to be more disciplined to make sure that the project has a positive real rate of return in order to justify taking on that risk of borrowing money so that on its own merits, without the benefit of inflation, the particular project earns a rate of return in order to pay back the debt. But with inflation, it distorts that. We can see how an inflationary environment encourages financialization, such as the financialization of homes, where we live, shelter. People buy houses, second houses, not because they need somewhere to live, but because they need somewhere to put their debased currency in order to hopefully real estate will hold its value. Houses aren't treated as homes. They're treated as an asset. It's that demand for multiple homes and people coming from overseas where their currency is being debased to buy homes in another country that generates higher demand for houses. And if an area has a housing shortage, that can push up the prices even more. So as we step back and think, well, how do we get here? Why is currency like this? Currency used to be backed by gold, but, and Alden points this out in her book, gold's not terribly convenient. You can't easily divide it. And to settle transactions, it's a physical item. You have to ship it different places. We want access to cash now. There's an advantage to having cash, money, digital. Nice to have the paper bills and coins, but it's nice to be able to send money to somebody digitally, electronically. And because of that, and because, frankly, it's just easier for governments to print money rather than collect taxes. It just happens. The money supply grows significantly year by year, 6% per year in the U.S. But that's just the system we have, but it doesn't have to be that way. In Japan, it wasn't for many years, partly because they had a big debt bubble and that was deflating, but also the population was aging the demographics, population was shrinking, and companies were becoming more productive, more technologically advanced. They had very stable prices for decades, even though the central bank and government officials trying to do everything they could to have inflation so they could be included in the countries that were normal. I would prefer stable currency, very, very low levels of inflation. It's just we've bought into this inflationary mindset, even though there are many goods and services that we're used to them falling in price or holding stable, things such as gasoline, airfares, clothing. Now, one of the things that I do is I do have currency diversification. I own gold, and it's done well, and I've owned it for many years. I own Bitcoin. Bitcoin differs from gold because it's digital. It also is scarce. The amount of Bitcoin created each year is less than the amount of newly created dollars and other fiat currencies. But gold and Bitcoin are not convenient as money because you do have to pay capital gains tax if you sell it to go buy something. But it does hold its value, and it can be used as a currency. I have used Bitcoin as a currency, despite its inconveniences. But I think having some monetary diversification makes sense because we do live in an era where the money supply continues to increase. We do have inflation, and so we do have to take action to offset that. And we do that through investing, and in the case of gold and Bitcoin, in speculating because there is no cash flow. Continued increase in gold and Bitcoin depends on the willingness of individuals and firms to own it, that they think it will have value, that they will believe it's a substitute for money, that it's a bona fide asset. And if there is not trust there, if nobody values it anymore, then doesn't matter if it's scarce, nobody wants to own it. So there's that underlying premise. But gold's been that way for millennia, Bitcoin for just over a decade. It is gaining that trust, and it has. I hold it along with many other investments because we live in an inflationary world. But don't beat yourself up if you like stable currency and don't like price increases. That's normal. Not having an inflationary world in a world where money supply is growing so quickly, often through manipulation by the central banks and government, that's not normal. But it's the world we live in now. That's episode 475. Thanks for listening. Warren Buffett said that to invest successfully over a lifetime, what's needed is a sound intellectual framework for making decisions. Money for the Rest of Us is built to help you learn and develop a successful investing framework. That's why on Friday, May 3rd, we're hosting a free special investment webinar to showcase three powerful new tools and the investing framework we've recently added to AssetCamp, our suite of stock market research and analysis tools. Come see how our tools are applied to our own investment portfolios as we walk you through actionable market insights we've gained using AssetCamp this month. Plus, ask your questions about the stock market and AssetCamp in a live Q&A session at the end. This webinar won't have a hard sales pitch. It's simply an opportunity for us to show you what we're proudly working on and to share knowledge that has helped us. Space is limited, so sign up soon. For more information and to register, visit assetcamp.com/webinar. That's assetcamp.com/webinar. assetcamp.com/webinar. Everything I have shared with you in this episode has been for general education. I've not considered your specific risk situation. I've not provided investment advice. This is simply general education on money, investing in the economy. Have a great week.